Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 160 of Registry Matters. Happy Saturday night to you, Larry. How are you?
Saturday night?
Oh, crap. That's right. Sunday afternoon. My bad. Sorry, a little bit of a time warp.
Yeah,
but what have you been doing that we had to push it back?
Well, I serve on the board of directors of NARSOL, and we were doing our annual long-range five-year planning and reviewing budget, and it was a 2.5 day. Well, I should say 2 and a fraction of a day. We did Friday, Saturday, and a couple hours today. So I would have had to. We would have had to have recorded very late last night if we had chosen that, and then we have a guest who was not available, so we moved it to Sunday.
And we still have like 100 people listening to us live in chat.
Isn't that amazing?
It's pretty awesome. Just put out the word and they show up. Do you want to give us a quick little rundown on what's going on tonight or today? Today?
Well, we're going to take some questions that we received from listeners. I don't know if I should refer to them listeners or readers when they come to us through the print site. But we've got some questions. And we've got a case from the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit dealing with out-of-state registration in Indiana. And we've got the issue of polygraphs. And we've got a case that we've talked about on previous occasions. I can't say how many on the podcast out of the Tenth Circuit dealing with those who are required to take polygraphs as a part of monitoring of probation and parole and supervised release. And we have the actual litigant in that case, Brian Von Behring, with us as a guest.
Excellent. Awesome. All right. Well, we will get to Brian in just a minute. And let's do this first question. This should be pretty quick. It says, to whom it may concern. My name is Patrick, and I was told that you may be able to help me out. I'm a registered PFR in the state of West Virginia. I'm inquiring if you would be able to help me find out what the laws are regarding PFRs and registration in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Also, if you would be able to get the information what rules PFRs are subjected to while on parole and probation. I have 50 years, that's a long time, Larry, of probation in West Virginia to complete, and I'm looking to relocate, no doubt. I have wrote to the respective states and have had no luck getting any information. And I have no one to help me get any info. Thank you so very much. So I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this one. But what do you think the answer is, Larry?
Well, first of all, we appreciate the question. It got delayed to us because it was sent to our address in Raleigh. And all that does is keeps mail from being processed. So if you're going to write to NARSOL, please write to the operations office in Albuquerque, and we'll get to it a lot faster. But having said that, I'm actually going to answer this. I think we're going to have space in the next issue of the newsletter, but I thought I would start it on the podcast. There's so many things in here that are relevant to everyone. And he's wanting to move out of state. So clearly when he says he has 50 years, that means he would like to transfer his supervision. And since that's a state conviction and not federal, he's going to have to go through the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. And he's been writing to states, but as we've said on previous episodes, which he wouldn't have access to necessarily, they do not want you to come. That is why they have not answered you. They do not want other offenders that are forced to register to come to their states to be supervised, because in their calculation, that increases the opportunity for recidivism, and they have to explain why it happened on their watch. And they would rather it happen on West Virginia's watch than on their watch. So therefore, you're not going to get a whole lot of interest in helping you find out how to navigate the process. But I'll help you. Your conditions that were imposed in West Virginia, they will follow you. You will not escape the 50 years of supervision, nor will you escape any single condition that they imposed in West Virginia. If the court said, gave you a list of things, which they generally do at the time they imposed the probation, those will follow you. The state that you move to will be bound to impose all of those conditions and monitor them for compliance and report to West Virginia if you do not comply. so you will gain no advantage by moving. Now, having said that, if there is something in the state of West Virginia that has been ruled unconstitutional in the state you're going to, they will tell West Virginia that they cannot enforce that. But that's going to be a long shot. You know, they will not attempt to address the 50 years. That's not anything they're going to look at. But if there were something that was specified in your conditions of supervision that have been declared unconstitutional in the state that you're going to, they would be notified that that particular condition or those conditions are unenforceable here, and then West Virginia would have the opportunity to remove them, or they would deny your movement to another state. In terms of the question about can we give you registration information about Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas, it's not really feasible to do that because, A, it changes every year. So depending on when you're getting out, there could be significant changes by judicial decision or by legislative enactments in those states. So that would be one thing. And then he wants to know about conditions of parole and probation. Your West Virginia conditions are going with you, and you might pick up additional conditions in the state because they're allowed to impose conditions on you that are consistent with how they supervise PFRs in that state. So they could conceivably add additional requirements upon you, and you're obligated to follow those.
So by moving while you're still under supervision, you end up with the worst case scenario of what you had and what you will have. And they're going to, some degree, combine, and you're going to end up with worser.
It is most likely you're going to end up with, we could say it differently, you're not going to improve your situation. And you could end up with more. If you were to come to my state, I can assure you as bad as the 50 years is we don't have a probation terms that long. But as bad as the 50 years is, you could have additional conditions that may have not, suppose they don't have curfews in West Virginia for people under sex offender supervision. You will have them here. And they are bona fide, and you will have to follow them. Because if you don't follow them, they will report back to West Virginia that a special condition of supervision is being violated, and West Virginia is obligated under the Interstate Compact to take that violation seriously. And you could end up back in prison in West Virginia for violating a condition that was imposed in the receiving state that was not imposed in the sending state. In your case, would be West Virginia.
Hmm. Well, there you go, Patrick. There is information for you, and I hope that helps guide you down the path for future. Larry, you said that you would take over introducing our guests, and so please go ahead with that.
Okay, welcome everybody out there in I start to say radio land. I just can't break myself from that, from in internet land. We have a special guest, which I don't think we've even done before. Have we had an actual party to a case on here before? We've had attorneys.
I don't believe
for
so.
Cases, but
no.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever have had the actual individual that did the case. No.
So yeah, this is a first. But this is such an issue that will come up repeatedly because of its significance and relevance. So we've talked about polygraphs and whether they can do them. And we actually have a party to the case out of the 10th Circuit, which is basically the Rocky Mountain part of the United States, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. Our litigant and our guest is Brian Von Baron. And he was successful some number of years ago, and he's going to tell you how many it is, but he was successful with getting a stay he was ordered to take a polygraph test, and he objected on the Fifth Amendment grounds, and he was able to get a stay moments before the polygraph, and then he was ultimately, when the case was resolved, it was resolved in his favor. So welcome, Brian. Thank you for joining us this week on Registry Matters.
Hey, thanks, Larry and Andy. Happy to be the first of the actual kind of litigants you have, and hopefully, if cases continue to go our way, you'll have some more in the future.
So, what year was this case decided? What senility is showing here? I don't recall what year it was.
Yeah, 15.
I was thinking around 16. Yep. Okay. So, well, Andy is going to be generous enough to guide this part of the program because of what I was doing over the weekend, did not prepare. So I'm going to just sit back and jump in if I need to, but otherwise, Andy, it's all yours.
All right. Perfect. Well, I guess we could just run through these quick little questions right off the bat and dig into some details later. Can you, and I have great interest in this because I'm just all about some science and from where I sit, a polygraph is just a whole bunch of smoke and mirrors and, you know, it dings and bells and whistles and whatnot. But can you describe how the polygraph works? Let's just start with that.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting. You know, the polygraph has been around for quite some time. And it's definitely not anything that is allowed in most kind of criminal proceedings, as, you know, Larry's pointed out before. But from what I've seen and from the research I've done, it does have some accuracy to it. I don't think that it should be used, obviously. But that has to do with more the kind of the way it's administered and kind of some necessary trickery that goes on the part of the polygrapher. But when it's administered according to the kind of polygrapher standards, it actually is somewhat accurate. I've seen rates of anywhere from, you know, the false positive rates of as low as about 5% in some of the studies I've seen. But that's really for like specific issue things. But for us, you know, for PSRs or PFRs, we tend to have either maintenance exams or sex history exams. And for those, the reliability drops pretty dramatically, you know, as evidenced by just the number of people who, you know, fail polygraphs. And then, it, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know for sure when it's a false positive, when the person, if the person doesn't admit to it. But the rates of failures are much higher for the sex offender community than it is for, say, like the CIA applications they're used on.
I'm struggling with the false positive rate of how you would actually know, how would somebody know that it has what would be the conditions that someone does administer a test where the false positive rate is that low?
The tests they've done, where they have an actual false positive rate have been controlled studies where they have a person who, the person taking it doesn't know the answer if it's true or false, but the person controlling the study does. So they will ask them a question about something in their past, and they'll know the answer ahead of time, and then they'll ask them anyways. And then if the polygraph indicates deception, they know, and the person was telling the truth because they didn't know the answer to the question, then they'll consider that a false positive. But there's you know, a bunch of statistical issues with those kinds of studies and things like that. So it's kind of hard. And that's one of the reasons why some of the courts have been, you know, have you know, held that they're not, you know, reliable enough to be introduced for most criminal proceedings. So,
right. And I just wrote that question down. I was like, why isn't it admissible in court?
So that, I don't know the full reasons for it. I know it's been a pretty long held, at least, you know, in terms of recent history. And I think there are issues of just that reliability in some of those studies that were done. But I don't know the, you know, exact reasons. It didn't, I know there that many, for most courts, it doesn't meet the standards for expert testimony or for an expert to be able to qualify and quantify and say that, hey, these polygraph results were valid and, you know, this means that he was lying and those kinds of things. And I think the big part of it, too, is that I think when the people I've talked to and myself, when I first took the polygraph tests, I kind of assumed that I kind of knew how they worked, like in the back of my head. I'm like, oh, OK, I see what they're doing. And it turned out I was pretty much completely wrong on it. And I think that once I did some research and once I kind of, you know, took them myself and kind of realized how they were working, it kind of, once you know it, opens up this intentional deception on the part of the polygrapher. And I think that the courts also know that. And once that gets introduced into courts, it becomes very hard to defend both the efficacy and the how effective they are, I think.
What does the polygraph then measure?
So the modern polygraphs, they measure four or five different physiological results. Almost all of them measure breathing, and then they also measure sweat in terms of the electroconductivity of the fingerprints, heartbeat, movement, how fidgety a person is. And there's a couple other ones. There's not a single, any one set standard, but heart rate, breathing, and essentially sweating through the electroconductivity are kind of the major ones. And then there's
blood
a
pressure?
Couple different. Yeah, yeah. Yes, blood pressure as well. Yes.
And then and they when you started, I'm trying to not jump too far ahead. When they started, they give you all of the questions that they're going to ask you, right?
They do. They have, so the polygraph exam is divided into the interview or the pre-polygraph phase, and then the actual exam, and then sometimes, depending on how it went, a post-interview phase. And the pre-polygraph interview phase, that's actually, in a lot of ways, the most important part of it. That's where the polygrapher will go over the questions with you and make any kind of narrowing or broadening constraints to the relevant questions. The interview phase is also where you, as the person taking it, your kind of goal in that phase is to identify what the control questions are. And that kind of gets into that that deceptive piece that the polygrapher is kind of trying to trick you into doing there. And I can go into a little bit more of that if you'd like, or
yeah, sure.
So for most polygraph exams, this isn't all of them, but the polygraph exams that follow the kind of there's an association, American Association for Polygraphers or something like that. They have guidelines, and for both specific issue and more general exams, a lot of people think that what the polygrapher is doing once he reads the results is he's comparing how your breathing was, how fidgety you were, your blood pressure, your heart rate. It's comparing that to an absolute value. And if it's above a certain amount, it means you were lying. And if it's below a certain amount, it means you were telling the truth. And that's not the case at all. All of the readings are relative. And because every person's different. And what they're relative to are control questions. And I think that when you hear questions like, is your name Brian? Are you sitting down? Are you in an office? Those types of questions, people tend to think those are the control questions, and they're actually not. Those are irrelevant questions. The polygrapher asks you those kinds of things just to make you think that he's calibrating the machine, or he or she is calibrating the machine, or to give you more confidence in the exam itself. But the actual control questions are questions that to you sound like they're relevant, sound like they're meaningful, but they're issued in such a way that they are broad enough or generic enough or encompassing enough that they intentionally cause you to have some apprehension when you answer them. They're questions that aren't relevant in the terms of being scored, but they're things that will cause your breathing to be different or cause you to sweat more or your blood pressure to go up. And the idea is that when you answer those questions during the exam, those serve as your baseline. And then that's your relevant questions are compared to those. And if you have a higher response to relevant questions than you do the control questions, the question is scored as dishonest. And if you have a lower response to the relevant question, the control question, then it's deemed as honest or non-deceptive, as they would say. And those control questions are fundamentally the key to everything in the polygraph exam, because without them, they have no way to score the exam. And once a person knows what the control questions are, they lose their power. If you know that their question they're asking you is designed to cause a response in you, then you either can intentionally kind of bring up about that response, or you can, you know that that's the level that you're comparing everything else to. And so, for example, some of the like the common control questions you'll see in the maintenance polygraphs for sex offenders are things like, have you kept any secrets from your probation officer? Or have you broken any other law, no matter how minor? What was the one I always liked? Have you had any contact with anyone you shouldn't? And they're
these awfully vague.
Right.
It's an awfully vague question.
Exactly. And they're supposed to be. You're supposed to be thinking like, oh, man, like, am I keeping secrets from my probation officer? I mean, well, I'm not telling him everything. Oh, man. I mean, I haven't lied to him. Oh, but shit. You know, I sorry. I apologize.
No, go ahead. Go. It's not that family friendly.
You know, but I didn't tell them that I was 15 minutes late for my job. But they don't really care about that, right? Does that matter? And you're like, ah. And that's the exact response you're supposed to have. Because if you are, you know, freaking out a little bit about a control question, and then they ask you, you know, at any time in the last 6 months, have you had contact with a minor that you didn't disclose to your treatment provider or something like that? Then, and you're like, oh, well, no, I haven't at all. Well, that's perfect for them because your level of response to that question, which should have been somewhat, you know, triggering for you, right? It's like, ooh, minors, you know, I'm treatment, I can't do that. It was lower than your, did I ever, you know, was I keeping anything from my probation officer? And you would pass, or you would score that question as non-deceptive. The problem comes about when, what if you really believed, like to yourself, like, no, correct, I tell my PO everything. There is nothing he doesn't know about me. And you answer that with, you know, the calmest, most straightforward manner. Well, now your level of your control question is really, really low. And now at best, if you answer the relevant question, you know, contact with minors or something like that, it's going to appear so close to your control question that it's going to get a non-response. They can't score it. Or maybe mm-hmm. you have just like just a little bit of a like, ugh, minors, ugh, or whatever, when you were dead set on that control question, and now it's going to get scored as deceptive because your level of response to it was higher. And so that to me, once I kind of found that out about the polygraph exams, I got pretty, I got pretty upset because, you know, in the context of treatment, especially for sex offenders, honesty and confronting what we did and all of those are very big components to it. And to have the polygrapher essentially trick me into being nervous or whatever you want to call it, having anxiety about a question in order for me to score the exam seemed unethical, honestly. And that kind of started my my road to, you know, learning more about it, and then, you know, eventually, you know, challenging at least the sex history questions in court.
Let's say that you have like a perfect scenario, like you're just following the rules, everything is working the way it's supposed to, and we're talking about working with a machine that doesn't work. So I have to constantly flip my brain around in circles to have this conversation, but. Suppose you stick to your guns and you consistently tell them, I'm not lying. I'm telling you the truth, but it says you were deceptive on the machine here. I'm telling you the truth. I'm not being deceptive. Suppose you stick to your guns in that way. What happens then?
So it depends on what the context of the polygraph exam was. For me, and I'm speaking specifically for Colorado, Colorado's sex offender program is... pretty much, it's largely organized by the state. So individual treatment providers have some latitude, but not a ton. I think my experience in Colorado is pretty similar to a lot of other treatment providers or probation polygraphs. But they say, oh, okay. They, you know, they tell you to your face, okay, I mean, it could be wrong. It seems unlikely, but it could be wrong. You know, it hasn't really failed us very often before. But and then you have to retake it. And, you know, for instance, in the treatment programs in Colorado, if you were taking a maintenance polygraph every 6 months, and you failed one, then you had to retake it within 3 months. And if you failed it again, then it was 1 month. And it went all the way down to weekly, in some cases, every 2 weeks. And they would essentially you would have to keep taking it over and over again until you either passed that specific question or you admitted to them what was, you know, whatever you were hiding. And these are all
in those circumstances. Yeah. I was just going to ask you, who pays mm-hmm. for it if you have to keep retaking it?
The in Colorado and in most states, the person under supervision. Some states will put you in a payment plan if you can't afford it and have to take it, but you have to repay the money. And for Colorado, there were $300. And I think they've gone up a little bit since then, but that was the kind of the standard fee for any of the five or six polygraphers that that I went to.
How much was it?
$300 each.
Okay, yeah. So here it was like 225 or 250 or something, so you're a little bit higher. But so roughly in that ballpark, somewhere between 2-3. Larry, do you have any information that pushes it in higher than that range?
Well, the contracted amount that the supervising entities get, that's consistent with what we hear. But now, like if we were to contract with for a single test for our clients, we would pay about double that. The typical price is $500-$600 for a single polygraph, but they're buying in bulk.
Oh, we get a bulk discount. Love it.
You're benefiting from that. So they will tell you they've negotiated with the provider for a volume discount.
God, maybe we could get like some sort of PPO or an HMO or something to help pay for the polygraph. We could buy like polygraph insurance, get a group plan.
Side note, in Colorado, the largest polygrapher provider sits on the Sex Offender Management Board and has full voting rights and everything like that. But I'm sure that he has only the interests of the community in heart when he makes his decisions on how to vote and what regulations to add. So,
yeah, of course. What is the exam like for taking a poly?
So, for the maintenance exams, which are, you know, the ones I took, most frequently,
these are like compliance ones, right? Making sure that you've been in by curfew and you're not looking at naughty web pages, that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Okay.
They are tied to, conditions of supervised release or probation or parole or treatment, objective sometimes. And they're typically anywhere from 3 to 6 relevant questions. The Polygrapher Association basically says that you shouldn't do a kind of maintenance style exam with more than, I think it's 3 or 4 questions, but typically there's, you know, they go beyond that. The more questions a person is asked, the less relevant or the less accurate the exam is. And that's kind of just the way some of those studies work out again. But the questions are things like, have you accessed any internet capable device that you were not approved for? Have you, left the state or, the county or whatever your locations are without permission? Have you had any contact with minors that you haven't disclosed? If you have an alcohol provision, those are usually a big part of it. Have you consumed any drugs or alcohol? And they're usually tied to a specific time frame. So for the maintenance exams, if you take one every year, they're in the past year, or in the past 3 months or whatever like that. And that's usually a good way to identify the control questions. A lot of times the control questions loosen that time frame. They go from the last 6 months to ever, or they don't mention altogether. But yeah.
One of the things that like troubles me with what you just started describing there is that they sort of fit into a timeline. It says, hey, have you had any drugs or alcohol since the last time you had your poly? And maybe you're taking them annually, maybe you're taking them quarterly, and like, crap, I don't know. I don't know when I had my last drink. And just for the record, I don't drink anyway, so that's not really my issue. But I'm just, if you don't keep track of it, well, it was 73 days ago, and that's within the 90-day window. Like, how would you... It's really subjective and seems prone to get you jammed up and cause you to then, pop the polygraph off the mark, and then they're like, oh, you're being deceptive. You're like, no.
I would say, wouldn't that be something you would deal with? Wouldn't that be an issue you would deal with in the pretest interview, like on the 73 versus 90 days, when they ask you, have you consumed any alcohol? That would be something in the pretest interview, because you have these questions. So you would say, well, let's be clear, we're talking about this interval. Isn't that something you can clean up in the pretest interview and formulate the question to be more relevant, more precise, and less open-ended? Can't you do that?
Yes, definitely. The polygrapher will work with you during that pretest phase to apply whatever narrowing constraints that he's kind of allowed to, within the constraints of what the probation officer wants him to ask, with what you say. So yeah, if you're saying like, a year is a long time, like, I don't really remember. I mean, I know, you know, I know for sure that, you know, since my PO told me, you know, 9 months ago that I couldn't have any alcohol, I know for sure since I haven't had it before that. Then the polygrapher would go ahead and say, okay, well, since February 18th or whatever, have you consumed any alcohol? And they'll do that with you as long as the question you're trying to clarify is not one of the control questions. And this is another way to kind of find out what they are. If you're asking for clarifying or narrowing things in a control question, the polygrapher will make you feel stupid for asking that or for trying to constrain. It'll be like if he asked you, like, are you keeping any secrets from your probation officer? And you're like, I don't really know what you mean by secrets. Like, you know what I mean. You know what I'm talking about. I mean, is there stuff you're not telling him? And you're like, I mean, what does that qualify? Like, you know, is it intentional? He's like, you know what a secret is. You've been in treatment. They're all about, you know, not keeping secrets. And they'll it's a complete flip on their part between when you try to clarify the control question, when you try to clarify the relevant questions. And it's, I don't know. I've had a couple experiences where it's been kind of funny, just because it was a little too over the top, I think. And maybe the polygrapher didn't have quite the acting talent that, that he believed he did. But yeah, for all of the relevant ones, they'll definitely narrow them.
Well, I like the point you're making, because I had an off the record conversation with a polygrapher, and he said it almost precisely what you just said. When you ask for clarification, they will sometimes embarrass you and do a little theater to make you feel bad for wanting the clarity. So you're confirming what the polygrapher told me off the record.
Yeah.
And all of this is just, I think this whole thing is it's the opposite of the placebo effect. Here, take this sugar cube, it'll make your pain go away. It's the opposite of that. Here, we're going to scare the crap out of you to get you to admit to doing something, even though the kabuki machine doesn't do a flipping thing.
Yeah, I mean, the primary benefit to the treatment providers, and I'm not saying that this is not a legitimate benefit to them, or that it's something that, you know, that is necessarily wrong, but it's that the polygraph process is pretty effective in getting people in treatment probation to admit to violations of their conditions. If you look at the you know, revocations in sex offender treatment and for sex offender probationers, a good chunk of them stem from things that people admitted on during a polygraph exam. And it's usually during the pre or the post phase that happens. And some treatment providers treat a little bit differently. You know, for instance, it's less severe in Colorado if you admit to something in the pre-interview phase than if you lie about it. And I have my air quotes, my air fingers up for quotes for that. And then, you know, reveal it, you know, when you're confronted by your treatment provider or something like that. But that is the purpose they serve. And they kind of cloud that when they talk about it in, you know, if it's brought up during a revocation hearing, or if a person challenges the requirement that they take polygraph tests in their sentencing, you know, the treatment provider comes in and says, you know, this is a very useful tool. It helps, you know, offenders confront, you know, things they've done. By and large, sex offenders are a very secretive group who do horrible things and then hide them. And we need a tool to, you know, confront them and help them confront themselves on that or something like that. And a lot of it's BS, but there is a component there where it works to a certain extent, because people do get, you know, in trouble.
No, because they believe it works.
Stuff. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Someone in chat just said, my argument is, has any study or case ever shown that PFRs are more inherently deceptive to justify this extra level of scrutiny?
There have been nothing too recent, but there have been studies that back in the I want to say the one I read most recently was in the early 90s, and it was primarily normed on contact offenders. And it was when some of the polygraphs were being used kind of initially. They weren't even a requirement. They were, I forgot the exact context of it, but they found, at least compared to the normal population, whatever that was at the time, that there was more general dishonesty in people who had contact offenses. And then there was some things that kind of refuted that study, or at least cast doubt on its methodology and things like that. But yeah, I think by and large, with current sex offenders, especially for the growing community of online offenders, that it's we don't know. I think that the inference is that it is, but I don't think there's any studies that back that up.
Is it legal or constitutional for courts, probation, to order someone to take a poly?
100%. Yeah. Time and time again, the courts at both the state and the federal level have upheld the requirement that someone on supervised release or probation or parole has to take a polygraph exam. There's the legal questions come on what kinds of questions they can ask you or what kind of questions you can refuse to answer. But as a polygraph as a whole, I'm not aware of any court that in the context of sex offender treatment that has said that the polygraph is so unreliable or so unethical or whatever that a person doesn't have to take it.
Larry, can you add anything to that about the legality of it?
Sure. It would be when realize put in context, you've been given conditional liberty. And with conditional liberty, additional intrusions are allowed into your life that would not normally be permissible. A regular citizen never has to submit to a polygraph pre-conviction. You know, they say, you hear all the time, the person was offered the opportunity to take a polygraph and they declined. But these are based upon, these are as a part of your conditional liberty, which you have less rights. That's how they're able to do drug and alcohol testing. As a normal citizen, they couldn't give you a drug test. I mean, your employer might be able to as a condition of employment, but as far as the police coming up to you and saying, I'd like you to take a drug test, they can only do that in probable cause if you are driving and exhibiting signs of intoxication. But this type of testing is allowed by the courts because it's your conditional liberty is something you don't have a right to. Therefore, it's a component to monitor your compliance with the conditions of your liberty. And the courts have said that a test upon it, just a simple test of a polygraph machine, it may not be completely accurate, but you can make the same argument about drug and alcohol tests. Are they completely accurate? Of course not. False positives show up all the time.
My challenge there, Larry, is it doesn't matter the person giving you the test. You've removed so many elements of ambiguity from that. It doesn't matter how you feel that day. If someone does a little bit of a blood draw and they do it, like, there is a predictable error rate, but the polygraph thing is fraudulent, like, all the way from top to bottom. It's completely subjective based on the person doing it and the person receiving it and how they feel that day.
Well, the courts have not interpreted the science that way. So you're barking up a tree that the courts don't agree with you on.
Yes, I understand that.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Brian, did you want to throw in something there with that?
Yeah, so I do think there is a little bit of a some confusion surrounding what kinds of things a person does or feels or how they are, you know, react will affect how the polygraph exam is scored. And the polygraphers say, by and large, it doesn't matter if you're tired that day or if you had caffeine or if you're, you know, depressed or anxious or whatever. And for the most part, it's actually kind of true. The only thing that matters is the difference between the delta between your response to the control questions and to the relevant questions. And things that tend to either increase your responses, like, you know, you're high strung and you just, you know, down, you know, two monster energy drinks right before there and you're bouncing off the walls. That's fine for the polygrapher because it's going to raise the level of the control questions and the relevant questions roughly equally. And the same thing if you're, you know, if you, you know, people, you know, took a some kind of sedative or, you know, some leftover pain medication or something like that before the exam, it's going to lower the responses to both of them as well. And that kind of tends to also go along with, you know, psychological, you know, whether you're, you know, have a lot of stress over it or things like that. They tend to kind of balance out. And my experience, at least from people I've talked to, more or less back that up. I haven't found any kind of like implicit kind of correlation between people failing it more often who were, you know, tired or overly distraught versus people who, you know, just went in there like a normal every day and took it. So I think it's kind of interesting.
Are you able to refuse the polygraph?
Sure. You are. The polygrapher, when you go in, makes a very big point, at least in Colorado, of saying this is entirely voluntary. The polygrapher is not forcing you to do it. They are not strapping you into the chair and they are not handcuffing you to it. And the door is not locked. You can walk out and leave at any time. Now, of course, there will likely be consequences for doing that. And if we're asking, can you refuse it without legal repercussions? It really depends on how it's worded. If it's a condition of your probation or parole, then you very easily can be revoked or violated for refusing to take a polygraph exam. And this is, I want to specify that this is you refusing to completely take it. You being ordered to do it and you just saying, telling your PO or your treatment provider, no, or just not showing up for it. There have been cases where people have been violated for nothing other than that. They're not real common. They tend to usually have other kind of factors too. But I did read a case a few weeks ago out of, I think it was Iowa. It was a state case, but the probationer was violated. He was doing everything in treatment. He was following. His treatment provider came in and said he's doing very well. He's participating in his classes. He's made a lot of strides for, you know, talking about his offense and things like that. And he just refused to take the polygraph exam. And after the second or third time he refused it, he got violated and the judge upheld it because it was a condition of his supervised release. And he went, you know, back to jail for a few months. And at the federal level, it's the same way. If it's a requirement of the treatment provider and not listed as an explicit condition of your supervised release or probation, then it's up to the treatment provider to kind of what they want to do. But ultimately, if the treatment provider says that you're not following their rules and they kick you out of treatment, then that usually can trigger a revocation because you have a condition that says you have to participate in treatment.
A buddy of mine up the road from me, this was around a holiday time frame. This was like 5 years ago. The treatment provider said, I need you to take this poly. And he was working like $8 an hour, like manually, you know, like hauling steel tubes around in a factory or something like that. And they said, hey, we need you to take this poly. And he's like, hey, look, I don't have the money for it. It's Christmas, bought some presents. Like, well, if you don't take the poly, then we're going to have to end your treatment and that'll revoke you. So his probation officer let him have like a buy and said, well, you can do it next month. But that was like, so he went off and title pawned his car so he could pay for the polygraph.
Yeah. I've come across people in Colorado with the same thing, you know, who were, they had exhausted their, kind of their essentially in Colorado, some of the probation departments will pay for treatment or polygraphs or other kind of related costs for you. But there's a limit to it. And basically if, you know, at that limit, if you're still not able to, you know, have work or whatever and pay it, that's kind of it. They say, look, I'm sorry, you couldn't pay it. It's ordered to do it. And the polygrapher is not going to do it for free. And I've known people who've been terminated from treatment in Colorado because they were ordered to take a polygraph and couldn't do it for financial reasons. Yeah, I get extremely upset when I hear stories like that. So,
yeah, let's try and compress some of these down and just maybe two or three more questions. Do polygraphers have to be licensed?
They do not in most jurisdictions that I know of. In Colorado, they don't. They don't, at least in terms of the state having regulations saying you have to be a licensed polygrapher to be able to practice in Colorado. But the Colorado's Sex Offender Management Board, they will only refer DOC, state DOC inmates to polygraphers who are licensed under the National Polygraphers Association, whatever. But that licensing is, at least from my understanding, they kind of keep their requirements kind of close to their vest in terms of what it takes. But it's not that hard to do. And this, they don't want a lot of polygraphers in the state because, of course, that, you know, divides the pie up too much. And then they're not, you know, not able to, it's not as lucrative for the individual ones. But I don't know of any states that require licensing as a regulatory body.
All right. Let's see. Let me see. What happens with the results? Like we've seen, everyone's seen on TV where they have the little like heart rate EKG monitor where it's like scribbling all over the place when you are lying and whatnot. Is the individual allowed to see those results?
Surprisingly, no. And I, this is one of the things that shocked me the most when I started taking them, and everyone I've talked to, if you take them privately, of course, as Larry referred to earlier, you'll get them. But if you're ordered to take them, your treatment provider can see them and your probation officer can see them, but you usually cannot unless there's some kind of legal proceeding. And of course, and at that point, your attorney can request them as evidence, and then you can see them that way. But the polygrapher says they can't see them to you because it's against treatment modalities or something like that. And my belief is that they don't want you to see it because the way they score it indicates what the control questions are. And once you know what the control questions are by looking at the results, obviously, then the future tests become meaningless.
I'm wondering if you could then get those results and hire your own legit. God, I hate even saying those words. That you could hire your own and say, well, no, I challenge these results because I am this credentialed polygrapher. You know, I went to the Harvard School of Polygraphy. Mm-hmm. These things, it hurts me every time I say these words. But how would you even be able to challenge it if they own the Kabuki machine and they own the results and they're saying that you lied? You wouldn't have any way to defend yourself.
At least in Colorado, you can do that. That is one of the things that the Sex Offender Management Board has provisions in place for. But you can request another polygrapher to review the results. And so most of these are machine. The results are analyzed by a machine by algorithms that then spit out, you know, deceptive, non-deceptive, or no opinion for each question. And then the polygrapher, using his vast experience and knowledge of human behavior and all the other things they went to that Harvard school for, certify those results, or occasionally will say, and the computer said, non-deceptive, but I know this guy and I can tell, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll override it. You can have the raw results along with the commentary, the scoring of the written report sent to another polygrapher that's in the state, at least in Colorado. And then they can either confirm or say, no, I think he was wrong. I know of maybe a dozen people who've done that. Not once has the second polygrapher overturned or said anything even remotely bad about the first guy. Because, you know, they're a very small, tight-knit group of people. And, you know, they don't want you to be able to play one off each other. But you're never able to see them yourself. It has to all be sent electronically, you know, and stuff like that. So
it's one of the tops of the piles of pseudoscience from everything that I study about science. I only have one more question. Larry, do you want to throw in anything before I ask the final question?
Well, I've found this to be fascinating. I think we'll probably end up having him back because this is going to generate a ton of questions from people after they read the transcripts and hear this episode. Yep. So, I think I'll pass, but it's been fascinating. Okay.
So that leads my one last question is, do you believe it's an effective way to determine if the PFRs are following the rules, if they're being compliant?
Not mostly because of the fact, I mean, obviously that, I'll say that I took, you know, in my 3 years of treatment, I took, I at one point I was taking every 3 months. So I took quite a few of them. I was never dishonest. But I was also never, after the first one I took and I kind of realized this, I never had any kind of concern whatsoever of doing it. It was just a routine for me. Like, okay, God, here's another $300 or whatever.
You took them every quarter for 4 years. So you took what, 16-ish?
Well, so not quite. I actually had, my treatment was interrupted while my, case was being, appealed due to the stay, and so I wasn't in treatment for that period of time. But then afterwards, magically, once the 10th Circuit decided my case, my treatment provider immediately switched tunes from he can't be in treatment because he's refusing to take the polygraph to oh well I guess we'll maybe let him back in now.
Nice of them.
It was. I'm sure they had my well being at heart. But yeah, within a few days of the appellate decision coming out, I was re-enrolled in the same treatment program that had threatened to kick me out and violate me, and actually had kicked me out. Didn't end up not getting revoked. But yeah, when I went back in there, I was doing them every 3 months because I was using a computer for work and whatnot, and that to them increased the risk factor for it. I know kind of running short on time here. I do want to caution one thing, which is that for people who are actively in treatment, I think you need to make an individual determination on whether or not to attempt to kind of know the control questions. People are able to pass the polygraphs without doing that. The treatment providers, especially in Colorado, are extremely, extremely sensitive to any allegations of tampering or doing things to throw the machine off and things like that. And people who have knowledge of how it works, and when providers become aware of that, it can switch from, every friendly, congenial to, what are you trying to hide? Why would you ever know this? All of this kind of stuff. And I've seen people.
Well, the fortune teller gets angry at you too if you know how to read your, do palm reading. They get very angry at you when you know how to do their kabuki stuff. Larry, what did you have?
It just occurred to me when I was, as I was reflecting on something he said about the increasing, we typically tell people on the podcast, if you've told the truth and they tell you that the polygraph has shown deception, all I encourage you to do is to continue to say, I've told the truth. I can't explain, because they ask you to explain why that you're showing deception, and you just tell them, I can't explain that. But you've interjected something that never has come to my attention before. If they simply continue to increase the frequency of polygraphs because the machine says deception and you insist you're telling the truth and you stick to your guns, it sounds like they will eventually bankrupt you.
Correct.
If you're earning $9 an hour and they increase it from quarterly to a monthly to weekly, at some point, the $9 an hour will not cover it, and they will get you that way because they will bankrupt you. And I think there might be a legal cause of action here that has been unexplored and no attorney's ever thought of, that they're deliberately, in order to get the answer they're looking for, that they are going to put financial pressure on you that you cannot withstand.
I'm with you. I like it. Larry, run with it.
Did we lose Brian?
No, I agree completely. I think the financial burdens of treatment in general are some of the hardest, pain points. And it has gotten a little bit better in Colorado, but some elsewhere I've heard. But yeah, I mean, these are for-profit companies administering polygraph exams, mm-hmm. and generally, for-profit private, treatment agencies who are administering it. And amazingly enough, they want to get paid for it. And when they can exert that financial pressure to also increase their treatment goals, I mean, it's a win-win for everyone, right? maybe except for us, who are really the clients who are supposed to be the ones benefiting from all this. But I would say the financial issues were the most common reasons for people having problems in treatment or sometimes just getting kicked out of it.
That leads us down to that this almost creates a debtor's prison and or it's extortion.
Well, what we're going to do is I'm going to take some time to read Bearden versus Georgia, which is the last case I remember the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on. It's been decades ago about inability to pay. And if a person doesn't have the ability to pay, we're definitely going to have to come back on this issue. But it sounds like this is a potential Bearden claim to me.
Excellent. And Brian, if you would stick around, I have another question from a listener that came in via a letter. And you can, if you look over in the, if you can see the screen that I have over in the live stream chat, then you can follow along if you want to. But Larry wanted to beat this around with you for a minute. So it says, I hope you all had a great holiday. I write to you regarding an issue I don't know how to solve. I was released from Fort Dix, New Jersey in August. According to my conditions of release, I had to attend court-ordered therapy, which I'm doing. The first day of therapy, I was handed homework, sex offender disclosure questionnaire. I'm not sure if you're familiar with this document or if it can be accessed entirely online, but this is the most demeaning, arrogant, dehumanizing thing I have ever subjected to. I don't think I'm sensitive, but having been incarcerated at Fort Dix, a notorious PFR hunting ground by inmates and staff, but questions like, how many times did you have sex with dead animals? And did you ever kill someone during or after sex? Are just some of the myriad of questions which further dehumanize me. To me, this was filthy and was as bad as therapist who said that my disliking this questionnaire was my opinion. And there is a pro-necrophilia faction, or the PO who discouraged me from attending the gym because I might drag a kid in the shower like a lion dispatches a zebra at the waterhole. So, Larry, that's a very disturbing letter that we received. And what did you want to dig into this with Brian about?
Well, this is the sexual history questionnaire, which was at issue in his particular case. So when you got your sexual history questionnaire, how much did it resemble this type of questions?
Very, very much so. I don't recall if there was anything about necrophilia on there, but there were definitely questions on sexual contact with animals, and it was very detailed. It wasn't a questionnaire. It was a packet, and they called it that, and it was, I don't remember, 15, 20 pages, something like that. And yeah, it was a full, every encounter, every behavior during those encounters, since you have in living memory. I am not an attorney, of course, but I encourage anyone who has any of these kinds of questions to refuse to answer any of them that would implicate a criminal offense. I think it's as simple as that. If they're asking you questions about legal sexual contact, that's kind of up to you on if you want to answer those and what the repercussions would be if you didn't. But as far as I know, not all of the federal circuits have reached an answer to the question of can they ask you incriminating questions on a sex history polygraph. But the ones that have asked it have more or less fallen along with my case. I know the Ninth Circuit has reached the same conclusion, the 10th, and there's a few other ones that they've kind of worded it in different ways. But by and large, I haven't seen any recent cases where they have attempted to prosecute someone for refusing to answer or for invoking the Fifth Amendment rights. So I think it's becoming somewhat well established, just maybe not well known that you can refuse to answer those incriminating questions.
So, well, I found those questions to be very, very distasteful. But anyway, Brian, we will have you back again.
I guarantee that. Thank you so much, Brian. I appreciate
it. Anytime. Thanks, guys. Awesome show. Thanks for having me as a guest.
Thank you very much. All right, Larry, then let's move on to this other little shindig that you got going on. And I almost want to set it up by asking this question from our listener. Is that a halfway decent way to set it up, or do you want to set up the case and all that?
Oh, you can ask the question, sure.
All right, so one of our patrons, it says, Patron Mike from New Jersey, can Larry explain this in English when he gets a chance? Does it say what I think it says? For people convicted before 1994, which includes me, it seems that as I read it, if a person that has an offense before SORNA, Indiana will not force them to register. And so that was a question from a patron who put this in here, and you guys were not working together, but doing the same thing. This is a case out of Indiana, apparently, and it was 61 pages that I haven't had any time or interest in reading. And I'm guessing that you feel it's relevant to PFR. So tell us what's going on.
Well, it is indeed relevant, and we're gonna do a shortened version of it because I haven't had time to thoroughly analyze it. So we'll address the high points. But this case is a result of Indiana being a little bit too cute and how they decided to apply the law after a very important ruling from the Indiana Supreme Court in 2009 in Wallace versus the state. Wallace versus state. And in fact, that ruling was one of the earlier victories for PFRs. It goes way back to 2009.
And when you say they're trying to be too cute and they're trying to circumvent the Wallace ruling, what is the Wallace ruling?
Well, the Wallace ruling was a finding that that registration. Well, let's just talk about Wallace and then we'll get back to it. But the Wallace ruling was a result of many enhancements, which states just cannot help themselves from doing. They had souped up the registry exponentially from when it was created. And that decision decided that they had gone too far. And the Seventh Circuit basically cut and pasted from Wallace, and they put in registration, and I'm reading now. Registration requires more than simply appearing at the sheriff's office. The person registering must be photographed and provide information, including the name, date of birth, race, height, weight, hair color, eye color, identifying features such as scars and tattoos, social security number, driver's license and state identification card number, vehicle description and license plate number of any vehicle the registrant might operate regularly. Principal address, name and address of any employer or educational institution, any electronic email address, any instant messaging usernames, any social networking website username, and the dangerous catch-all, quote, any information required by the Department of Corrections. And that is a far cry from what is a part of your conviction. And as you've heard me say for the last 3 years on this podcast, if they were merely registering information about you relevant to your conviction, meaning stuff that was known to the court, like what you look like, your picture, what you were convicted of, and they said, go on and have a great life, you're registered, they could probably do that in perpetuity, but they can't stop at that. They just can't help themselves to put all these requirements. So in addition to the information I just read, this stuff is posted on the website, and you have 72 hours to report if you change any of this information, including anything related to the internet. If you create the court referenced a Pinterest account, what is that?
Yeah, Pinterest. It's a photo sharing website. People do a lot of recipes or craft stuff on Pinterest, just another social networking website.
So that was the case from 2009 where the Indiana Supreme Court said, you've gone too far. You can't apply all this stuff to people whose conduct predated the registration. So Indiana decided that in order not to have an influx of sexual offenders from other states, which no state wants that, that they were going to interpret Wallace in a way that would keep the floodgate closed. So if you move to Indiana, they had, even before Wallace came out in 2009, they had put a catch-all provision in Indiana statute that if you relocate to Indiana, or if you have a requirement to register in that state, or if it's equivalent to an Indiana offense, you'll have to register in Indiana. Despite this, so basically they created two classes of citizens. If you had an old sexual offense. And you never left Indiana, you were just fine under Wallace. But if you left Indiana and came back, and you registered in the state after you're leaving Indiana, because remember, Indiana's court ruling is only valid there. So if you moved to another state and you got on their registry, then you were coming back being required to register in another state. And some of these challengers that had that situation, or people who had just relocated to Indiana, and they said, well, what about us? They said, well, it doesn't apply to you. Our law says that if you move here and you have an obligation to register anywhere, you have an obligation to register in Indiana. So that's what this case was all about. And the Seventh Circuit said, no, doesn't work that way.
But does that introduce an equal protection issue under the Constitution? How is it that a state can require you to register simply based on what a previous state required when you lived there? I thought a person could travel freely and enjoy equal treatment from state to state, though.
Well, that's what the challengers asserted, in fact. And that's what the Seventh Circuit concluded, that absolutely you can travel to Indiana having an offense that requires you to register in another state, and that state's obligations do not magically transfer to you in Indiana, because the Indiana law would not have recognized you as a sex offender if it's not equivalent. So they said that very thing. And they also said, since you have a freedom of movement, if you leave Indiana and decide to come back, that somehow or another that doesn't reimpose an obligation that had already been jettisoned by a previous Supreme Court ruling. So this is a fantastic decision. Now listen, people, fantastic. This is fantastic in terms of its potential reach. So this could impact a large number of people. But now keep in mind, the people this will impact cannot grow. It's a decreasing number, because you would have to have an older offense. You can't roll back the clock and have an offense.
Or something like that.
Yeah, you can't roll back the clock and have and magically have an old offense. Well, I guess you could if there's no statute of limitations and they prosecute you for something. But as a general rule, this is going to have a diminishing component. Well, they call it a cohort of people that this applies to. But you can, under this ruling, live in Indiana if you have an old conviction, and they cannot require you to register.
Were any of these judges appointed by Trump?
Well, what do you mean by appointed by Trump?
I guess during the 4 years of his term that he would have nominated them, and then the Senate confirmed them.
So, well, yes. So let's be clear. This was a three-judge panel, because it's an appellate decision from the Seventh Circuit. So, in fact, one of them was appointed by Trump. But she had already been a district judge, which is the lower level, the trial court level. She had already been appointed by President George W. Bush, and she was the dissenting judge. And then of the two remaining judges, one was appointed. We have a bipartisan. One was appointed by Clinton, and one was appointed by Reagan as a district judge and was elevated to the Court of Appeals. So we had a 2-1 decision. There is a dissent. I have not read the dissent. I will read the dissent by the time hopefully we come back next week, because in this particular case, it could be relevant, because this is not necessarily the final stop.
Okay. And what will happen next then? Will Indiana file to try and get the Supreme Court to hear it?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I'm hoping not. My recollection is that Wallace, the Supreme Court decided in Wallace based on the Indiana Constitution, but Wallace is so old I'd have to reread it. But if they decided based upon the state constitution, they will have boxed in the federal court the same way that in Pennsylvania, when the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, or was it Michigan? But I think it was Pennsylvania, but they said don't bother trying to undo this by your interpretation of the Constitution, because our Constitution provides a great level of protection. Therefore, we're interpreting it under the U.S. and the Pennsylvania Constitution. Well, if my recollection is correct and they interpreted the Indiana Constitution, then the Supreme Court doesn't have a final say-so if Indiana chooses to provide its citizens greater protections than the U.S. Constitution.
I do believe that covers the whole thing.
No, you missed one.
I did.
So there, and it was more me missing it. But there is another theory that they can put forth, and they can put forth that there's an independent federal obligation to register under the Adam Walsh Act, and that would be more likely what they would do. They would cite to the Sixth Circuit, although it's not binding. They would say, "Well, look at this marvelous decision from the Sixth, which was out of Michigan." and they would say that there's an independent duty to register under federal law, and therefore these people that move here, they have traveled in interstate commerce, and they have a federal obligation to register, and therefore we still can't release them. That would be the argument that they would most likely think of. And believe me, folks, if I can think of it, so can they. So I'm not letting any cat out of the bag. That's what they're going to argue. That would be what I would expect them to pull out of their hat, would be to assert that there's an independent federal obligation. So if they do file a cert petition, that's what they would put in the cert petition. They would skirt the Indiana Constitution, because they wouldn't try to tell the Supreme Court of the United States to interpret the Indiana Constitution. But they would say, notwithstanding the Indiana Constitution's interpretation, there's a federal obligation to register. And then the U.S. Supreme Court, if they were to grant cert and review the case, they would tell us whether there's an independent federal obligation to register. And being that we have a conservative Supreme Court that definitely wants to help the PFRs, I have no doubt it would be 6-3 in favor of there's no federal obligation, because that's just what they would do.
You're not being facetious, are you? I'm sensing a little bit of sarcasm.
No, not at all, Andy, not at all. And they very well could do that. We cannot predict what courts are going to do based on conservative versus liberal, but that would be the likely argument that they would put forth in their cert petition if they were to file one.
I see. Anything else you want to talk about PFR related? And before I have this nice, endearing letter to read, and then a couple other things. Is there anything else you wanted to do before we, get ready to close the doors?
I think I've done the best I can with the quick read I've done of this case, and hopefully we can develop it further and come back to it next week or following in a future episode.
All right. Well, then I would like you to cue the heartwarming music. It says, Dear Andy and Larry and the team. I guess it just says, Dear Larry and the team. I don't get even a mention in this letter. A couple of months ago, I requested a sample transcript of Registry Matters. I really liked it, but I thought $10 a month was too much, and time went on, and for some reason I continued to receive your transcripts. I don't receive much mail, so it's been nice getting the transcript every week. Then you lowered the price to $6 a month, and I have been on the fence. Then I got a Christmas card. After almost 5 years incarcerated, the amount of Christmas cards I receive each year declined more and more. For you guys to sit down and send a card to not only to subscribers, but to someone who only requested a sample a few months ago means a lot to me. And I'd like to subscribe for however long $50 will get me. Please continue to keep up and really give hope at the same time. Just wanted to share that with people. I know I'm so mistreated. Thank you, Jen. I appreciate the acknowledgement that I'm mistreated. Just wanted to highlight that someone wrote in a very nice letter to us, to Larry, and then me, just as an aside.
So, well, I like the part about keep it real, but give us hope, and that's what we try to do. And the reason we were sending the transcript is I really have a soft spot for people who have served the country, and I feel like that the Department of Defense has been over the top in prosecutions, and not just military, but they have been over the top. It goes without saying in this business, but I wanted to make sure that he had a full understanding of the scope of what we cover on the podcast, and I was hoping that he would like what he saw, so I kept sending it to him as kind of a sales ploy to see if we could get him addicted. But
that's what you are.
but as we go forward, we're hoping that we can provide services to those who can't pay, and that's our goal for the nonprofit. That people kind of like what the NARSL model, where we provide subscriptions to people who are indigent.
Sure. Just to highlight that, though, that if you have 3, 4, 10 people in the dorm and you guys want to all get together, we don't care if you share it around the dorm. I mean, we don't need to have 10 subscriptions going to 10 different people in the same dorm. Please feel free to collect enough money up to support it. I mean, that would be perfectly okay. Even share it across the whole compound if you can. I'd perfectly be happy with that. Because then most of these people that are listening to this on the inside are going to get out. Otherwise, this really doesn't matter much. But so that you would come join the team and join the fight for when you get out. That's definitely one of the ideas. We're trying
Absolutely.
To indoctrinate people, Larry.
Absolutely. We're hoping that they can become patrons when they're on the outside at some level. And we're hoping that they can join the effort to push back. And so we have several motivations, but I'm glad that he appreciated the cards. I put some work into doing that, and I got one criticism. One person shredded the card up. but we've gotten more compliments. Yeah, someone, my heart was palpitations. I said, my goodness, we got this. And I thought that someone had handmade a gift for us. you know, they make these cellophane picture frames and they do all these creative things. And I thought, well, you know, this is a puffy envelope. So there's something good in here. And all it was the cards that we had sent, both from the organization and from Registry Matters. They were shredded up. He had torn them into pieces, and that had made the envelope puffy. So my ego went flat after I got that back, along with an ugly letter saying, "Why did you send me this Christmas card?"
Wow, that's kind of, I mean, like, even me and my staunch stance on all thing, I would be like, "Wow, that was very nice of you guys to send me a card. I wouldn't have like torn it up." Wow. Oh. That's interesting.
Yeah, he wanted
that wasn't
to make
the
sure
person
that,
in Atlanta that we know, right? That wasn't
no,
that guy, was it?
But he made sure that we understood that it cost him money to send it back to us, and they felt that strongly about it.
That's freaking crazy. All right, then. Well, then, so we can highlight that we got a new patron named John, but he's actually an old patron. He's like a returning one. And so thank you very much for coming back, John. I think there may have been some revocation issue in there. That's why he skipped down on being a patron for a while. And then to my good buddy pal, Shane, and he increased his patron by more than threefold. And thank you, my friend, and congrats on the house. And otherwise, Larry, we can shut the show down by just go visit us over at registrymatters.co. And that's you can find all the show notes, links, and all that good stuff there. That's all I have for the evening, Larry.
Do not forget, when you watch us on YouTube, to put, what is that? You check like.
Do like and subscribe and hit the bell to get notified, all that happy stuff.
Yeah, because we're trying to drive that algorithm, however it works. We need more. Yeah. Likes, we need more subscribers, and we'll eventually have people flooding our way if we have more views on YouTube.
Very good. That's all I got, Larry. I hope you have a great rest of your afternoon, and happy Sunday, and have a good week. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Andy. Good night, everybody.
You've been listening to FYP.